Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. And right there is why I went to Disco Demolition. What happened to Rod Stewart? It was awful. And I brought that record. I think it was Blondes Have More Fun that had that track on it. Do You Think I'm Sexy? So we've got a great panel with us. We've got Paul Natkin, who was at Disco Demolition on the Jeep, taking pictures, and they're in the book, Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died, Steve Dahl with Dave Hoekstra and Paul Natkin, with a foreword by Bob Odenkirk on Curbside Splendor. We have Dave Gaborik and Bob Chicoine, who worked the event, beer vendors, yes, friends of mine.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. And on the phone, we have Mike Vreck, one of my BFFs, calling from Charleston. Are you there, Mike?
I am indeed. I was certainly enjoying the ruination of Rod there.
Steve, you're on the phone.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, man.
When did your ships first pass in the night, Steve and
when did our what pass?
Your ships. SHIPS. I mean, when did you first meet, and as this thing came together?
Well, I learned.
I think Steve got off morning. What then was morning drive at 10 o'clock, and I must have been all over him around 10:03, and said, why don't you come out to Comiskey Park and try this?
And did I say no? Because I really didn't want to do it.
Well, no, you didn't say no. You were, obviously you weren't charming, but I mean, you said, hey, I went to Indiana a couple weeks ago, and we tried it in the shopping center. We had 3,000 or 4,000 people. But you didn't close the door completely. I knew I could wear you down.
So I was coy.
Are those ships passing?
Yeah, right.
Well, hi there, sailor.
One thing I tried to set up in the book, and people spoke to this, and I wanted to talk about Bridgeport, and I wanted to talk about class structure, which Steve did, and there was a chef there in Bridgeport. What was his name, Paul?
Kevin Hickey.
Just like the late White Sox pitcher. And he just talked about how much he related to Steve. He lived like three blocks from the ballpark, and he went to Disco Demolition because he was 10 years old, and he was a little heavy, a little overweight, and he was kind of a slob, and it just the class struggle.
Hey,
But the class structure is really important. Can both of you guys talk about what the difference between South Side, North Side, what Bridgeport was then?
Well, me, I'm from L.A., so I kind of learned about it, maybe a little bit that night and then more after that. I think Mike could probably speak to that better than I could.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I mean, there's a reason that Comiskey Park plays and the White Sox play most of their games at night, and that's because we all have jobs. And
right on.
If you go over to the North Side, they can play day games because they have time on their hands, and I think that we felt that line of demarcation, and it extended, to all things back then, White Sox. The thing I love about Chicago is if you go to New York, you can get away with saying, I love the Yankees, but the Mets are kind of cute. But in Chicago, there's a line of demarcation. You are a Cub fan or you are a White Sox fan. And never do a deal with somebody who says, hey, I love both teams.
We have beer vendors in the studio who worked that night. Can you talk about what the crowds were like at Comiskey? Not just even, that night, but also just the general crowd at Comiskey in 1979. Bob, Dave? Bob?
They were small. The Sox had a very good year in 77, but due to the economics mostly, they really floundered in 78, 9, and 80 before they were able to get Carlton Fisk. So they were lucky to get 15,000 on a weeknight. I forget what night exactly it was.
I think it was a Thursday night.
Yeah, you're right.
Sounds Thursday. Right. And so they ended up getting about three times that. So we were hard-pressed to keep up. The vibe coming in that night was weirder, as was the vibe in the ballpark, than I've ever felt to that point or later. And you just knew something was going to erupt. It was just all this pent-up energy. And there were some indications that prior to the game that something big was going to happen between games. Even our union steward, who was a great guy and fought for us no matter what we did, said for that game and that game only, he said, if you sell to a minor today, I cannot help you. So a lot of indications. Also, a vendor who worked every game had been to a couple of Steve Dahl events, one on Navy Pier just a couple weeks before, and maybe the one in Indiana. I think he mentioned it was Linwood, Illinois, and he said, this night is going to be up for grabs. I'm not going to go. It's going to be that crazy. And he actually took the night off. So there were some premonitions that this was about to happen. And if I can just speak to the class thing, at the very end of the night when we were able to finally clear out and get out of the neighborhood and we drove to the south side, I lived on the southwest side at that point, and from block to block you just heard these cries of triumph. It was just a huge victory for that part of town for those kids.
Yeah, and you guys all know, I mean, and one reason I wanted to do this segment is I'm already a little, and I really have empathy for stuff Steve has gone through about the whole racism and homophobic thing, because Natkin and I, you know, Natkin was there, I was there, and it was not part of the agenda. Can you guys just address that briefly? Mike, I mean, you and I have talked about it. Nobody talked about that then. It was just a bunch of kids.
Oh, that is so ridiculous. You know, that it started, at least for me, about 10 years ago. I think one of the Gibb brothers adopted that. We were on doing some radio show together. And he said, well, you know, I thought the whole thing was rather homophobic. And I said, and I absolutely said, if I knew what that meant, I'm sure that I would have some idea about it. It was preposterous. I mean, it was purely a rock and roll promotion designed around, you know, some stage things that Steve did in the studio, and never was there ever any intent other than to have a laugh at the expense of disco and trumpet rock and roll.
I mean, do people understand, I bring this up in the book, do people understand about your dad and marching with the civil rights movement? I mean, you know, you guys are the farthest thing, you know, from that. It's just way off base to go into that. Steve and I have talked, this is a time capsule. This is what happened in July 1979 at this ballpark, you know what I mean?
Hey, rock and roll hadn't been around that long, at least album rock and roll, the kind of rock and roll that the kids who listened to The Loop were into. It had maybe been around for a decade.
Right.
And just on the way home tonight, I heard, you know, The Who, Long Live Rock. And, you know, there's a reason that song came out then, because it's hard to imagine. But back then, after rock and roll had only been around for 10 years and all of its premier, many of its premier artists were starting to, you know, do disco and tread more towards a, you know, like a high-end club scene, you know, kids running around in T-shirts and jeans, I think they were starting to feel a little disenfranchised.
Right.
That's the extent of it.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's right. That's right. Both for Steve and Paul, what was the decision to do this book now?
I had the pictures for years, and they were just in a file cabinet, and Steve and I would talk about it every once in a while.
I was too lazy to write it, and then Dave came along.
I didn't want to say it, but since he said it, we'll go with that.
I didn't write it. I'm just with Dave Hoekstra. That's it.
But, I mean, yeah.
We need to be here.
But I mean, you know, we worked together. You looked over everything.
I was real proud. No, I'm kidding.
At the characters we dug up, though, I mean, I was able to get you know Lorelei and Nancy Faust, and we tried to get all the all the key players, and the radio people involved.
I think you did a fantastic job, and you got a lot of great baseball players, and a lot of great you got the baseball take on it, which I don't think anybody has ever covered before.
Right, and nobody's really, I'm not here to defend the book, but I mean, there's just some great stuff. We got Thad Bosley, we got Kenny Kravick. We got to get you a book down there in Charleston, Mike.
Well, and Sparky Anderson, of course, gave a tremendous performance that night. His Warriors couldn't go back on the field, you know. I mean, there were many, you know, Jack Morris, who pitched for us in St. Paul, and then with whom I worked with the Tigers, we called it a hell of a mess. You know, I know Nancy's always thought it was really a riot, but if she'd ever been in a real riot, I like to point out to her.
Seem to remember Jimmy Pearsall really liked it.
Yeah, he was really a homer that night, wasn't he? I gotta believe, Harry, these aren't baseball fans. Wow.
These are fans of far out, is what he says. They're fans of far out. They follow a jerk. I'd rather be swimming, he said. I'd rather be swimming. And he was wearing an outpatient T-shirt. Seriously.
What was it like for you guys to, Paul, I mean, how many pictures are in the book? I don't even know. And what was it like to go through those and look at those?
It was interesting because I didn't remember most of what happened, because it had been so long ago. But it was pretty wild to look at the pictures and see what had happened. I don't know how many pictures are in the book, but pretty much all the good ones that I had that night.
Yeah, I mean, there are some. I've seen a lot of them over the years because Paul and I are very close. And every year around July 12th, people will want photos or whatever. But there are some in the book that I hadn't seen previous to us sitting down and going over them.
As you revisited this, Steve, what came back to you? What did anything come back to you that you didn't expect as you read the manuscript, as you looked at the pictures?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the fact that there were so many other people involved, and there were things that happened before, during, and after that I had, it never occurred to me that these things had gone on, because I was pretty much just, at that point, fearing for my life, and then fearing for my job, because I was told not to talk about it the next day.
Right.
So I was very narrowly focused, as I believe, as is pointed out in the book.
Yeah.
But here's something I learned. When Mike was talking about the fact that he had to pull some of the yellow jackets off of the field to go protect the people that were selling tickets in the kiosks because the kids were going to tip them over like porta potties. That's where Mike thinks maybe he kind of maybe left his flank unguarded there a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's exactly where I believe the real mistake came when everybody, crowd control's a misnomer, obviously, like you mentioned. You go to a Who concert or a Rolling Stone concert, obviously, the kids, if they don't think is one, then crowd control works fine. But on this particular case, I think with 60,000 people looking down at the field was the focal point, and they see 15 of the yellow shirts move off. That's the real mistake I made when I asked them to move them outside, to take care of the ticket sellers.
Yeah, but those ticket sellers could have been killed.
Well, what I think about now is I told them to go out and protect all the old guys who are out there selling tickets that are my age now.
You can't get away from this kiosk!
Thank God so many of those kids were stoned, though. That's the thing that I think works, too. There was a haze, but you can talk about beer vendors all you like, but we sold a lot of popcorn that night. It was a hungry audience.
Mike, what was it like when your dad took all those hits? What went through your mind when your dad was taking all those hits on this event?
How unfair it was. I mean, he obviously had no idea, what disco was, what the promotion was. He knew that we'd done Teen Night, and he, left it to us, and in this case, to me. And when you see someone that you love, so just taking these shots with such grace, that he doesn't deserve. It's painful. It keeps you up a little. And I admired him as you get older and you realize what great leaders do. That's exactly what they do. They share the glory and defer to everybody, accolades. But when there's a bomb to fall on, they do it. And he did it well. And he was the one who said to me at 4 o'clock in the morning, McGill, sometimes they work too well.
Yeah. How soon did he sell the team after this event?
Well, we left in February of 81, so we gimped on for another year.
Did this accelerate the sale at all?
I think, as you look back in revisionist history, that's probably a conclusion one reaches. But I think the concerts held in August where the field actually was destroyed, that's what a lot of people mistake. July blends into August, and that was the same year we had the Barrelhead root beer fiasco in which it rained for the 2 days of that. So, did it cause it? It certainly didn't that. Maybe if we charge full price, or as I like to say, if everybody in the ensuing 30-plus years had been at Disco Demolition who tells me they were, my old man would still own the White Sox.
I have met about a million people that have been there, yeah. or that were there.
Yeah, it was hard to vet those in interviews for the book, too. You know, it was like,
pretty much everybody I talked to that said they were there said that they ran on the field, and there were really only about 250 people on the field.
can you guys hang around? Mike, I want to talk to you about Prince Night in St. Paul for a minute. So can you hang on a minute?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Don't go. We're going to take a break from the news, and we'll be back with our discussion on Disco Demolition. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, our discussion on Disco Demolition and Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died by Steve Dahl with Dave Hoekstra and Paul Nacken with a foreword by Bob Odenkirk. It's available on Curbside Splendor. We're so outside, Paul, that they have a tent at Pitchfork, and we're here. We're not we're cutting edge. So
we're not hip enough.
Yeah. So joining us is of course, Steve Dahl.
Hey, WLS. Dave.
Thanks again for coming in. I know you had a wedding tonight. WLSAM and the Steve Dahl Podcast Network. We've got my photographer friend Paul Nacken. We have vendors Robert Bob Chicoin and Dave Gaborik with Cindy from the Bleachers. Thanks for joining us, Cindy.
Hi, Dave.
And what I want to get at is, like, what was the moment, like maybe somewhere in the first game, and Mike Vec, what was the moment where you knew things were changing, when there was change in the wind that night? Like, was it during the first game? Was it before the first game? When did you get the idea that things were going to turn? Paul, you want to start with that?
Well, I got the idea after the records blew up. This Jeep came out on the field, and Steve and Gary got in the back of the Jeep, and I had this brilliant idea, probably the dumbest idea I've ever had in my life, to climb on the hood of the Jeep so that I could shoot pictures facing backwards of Steve standing in the back of the Jeep waving at the crowd. And the driver was going to make a slow turn around the whole baseball field. And he started going, and people started throwing full beers. They were throwing cherry bombs. They were throwing, and they were supposed to like us.
Yeah, those are the people that liked us.
So the driver freaked, and he put on the brakes, and he made a quick U-turn, and he just floored it to get out of there. And I'm on the hood of the Jeep holding onto a windshield wiper to keep from dying. And at that point, I knew it was a little bit crazy.
Yeah. I was in the Bard's room. Before the first game, I was down on the field with Lorelei, the original Loop Girl, and, you know, signing posters and stuff. And, I mean, it was a good crowd, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 extra people, and but it didn't seem like it was going to be much more than that. And I was up in the Bard's room having dinner, courtesy of the Vec family. And as the first game, you know, got into the later innings, Harry Carey is he started talking about the fact that, you know, this is teen night and there's a lot of kids showing up tonight. And I started paying attention after I heard Harry Carey talking about it.
Mike?
I think it's, I'm more like Paul. Once the explosion happened and I saw them slide down, there were some records thrown during the game and stuff, but, you know, I gave away 20,000 Reggie bars and they threw 19,000 of those on, you know, a couple of years before, so a couple of records on the thing weren't. That wasn't indicative to me, but once they blew and I saw the guy slide down the foul pole, I pretty much knew my life as I knew it was over.
Yeah, I wasn't hip to all the subtleties, I guess. I just thought it was going to be, you know, oh, gee, there's going to be a lot of people here. That's going to be great.
But, yeah, Steve, I mean, you really set the record straight. I mean, in interviewing you for the book, I mean, you really didn't expect any of this. You were kind of like a deer in headlights on all this. I mean, you weren't out to, like, create this big thing. I mean, you just kind of went along for the ride, right?
Yeah, you know, I started making fun of disco because I was mad because I got fired, you know, from a station that went disco. And so I just made fun of it because it was laughable, and it was, you know, it was any form of music is an easy target if you break it down, you know, lyrically and what have you. So I was doing that, and I had a band, Teenage Radiation, and we played bar gigs. And, you know, back in those days, you made more money on the side than you did at the radio station. And so one of the staples of all of my live show was playing my parody of Rod Stewart. Rod Stewart's Do You Think I'm Sexy? Do You Think I'm Disco? Breaking a record on my head, you know, stuff like that. So I was very content just doing that. And I honestly thought that even if I drew 10,000 people, that stadium is still going to be half empty and it's going to look like a failure. So I was not super keen on moving it to the bigger venue.
Right. Dave and Bob, when did you feel things were a little shaky in the ballpark that night?
Well,
what moment was that?
In the middle of the first game, the records were kind of flying around a little bit, and I'm thinking, whose idea is this? I mean, records at a ball game was, I think, the 98 cents to get in with the record, yep. And kids are climbing the walls to get in. The security had their hands full, and I go, this is really a little different. And place was rocking because it was so full, and it was never like that. Like Bob said, it was about 15,000 people, and I remember they always had a protocol of camera day. They would let fans on the field in an organized fashion, but this was just open where a few kids would run out in the field, join Steve, and no one stopped them. And then I saw this long-haired fella jump out of left field, run across the outfield, slide into second base, lift up the bag, and then everybody just poured on the field. Yeah. And it got real smoky. And I remember Harry Carey, you know, starting chanting back to your seats, and it wasn't working. And
Bob, same question.
Yeah, it was the middle of the game, and by that point we were just backed up against the walls, pouring beer like the defenders of the Alamo. And when I came in to pick up more cases, one vendor told me, you know, they're never going to play this second game. I said, really? And you could just, something was going to happen big. Yeah, I was actually surprised that it took so long to happen after the explosion, because it was one, two, it was a slow trickle, and then everyone jumped on the
field. Did you guys make a lot of money that night?
We didn't. They cut us off about 10 minutes after everyone jumped on the field. They cut beer off.
I was selling pop. I wasn't 21.
And at that point, actually, I got deputized by this makes me think that the Sox knew that they had something going on, because normally they had a bunch of off-duty policemen, Chicago policemen, as security, who you never wanted to mess with. But they had some extra security that night, and this guy suddenly came after me and said, I hereby deputize you. Go secure that area.
And citizens arrest!
Yes.
Citizens arrest!
What does that mean? I said, well, I get to live my lifelong dream of becoming Barney Fife, but but he sends me over to a ramp. Well, there's no one on the ramp. Everyone's on the field or in the seats. And if they are on the ramp, they're leaving the park. So he runs off to address some situation. After 5 minutes, I said, what, am I an idiot? I didn't even get a badge for this. So I went out and just watched the rest of it.
Bob and Mike Beck, do you remember the brand of beer you were selling? Was it Schlitz? Or what was the beer you guys were selling?
I think that was the year they switched from Schlitz to Old Style, which we didn't think would actually work on the South Side, because that was thought to be a North Side beer.
But I think it was $1 a can.
Yeah. I actually think it was 90 cents.
90 cents.
It was a big thing to get that.
When I got beer, 80 was $1. Yeah.
Actually, when we switched from Stroh's to Schlitz, a year or two before that we actually had a bigger riot over that.
Mike, you and I were talking the other day. It's the way things have progressed. I mean, so here's Steve on the flagship station, WLS, and I think the White Sox should embrace this whole thing. I mean, I'm a Cubs fan, but I go to a couple games a year. The last time I was sitting in the bleachers, I heard they were playing Macho Man, you know? So it's about time, and they make it part of their – it's a great part of their history. What do you think about the way, you know, musically people look at it now, Mike?
Oh, I think it's one of those moments it's a defining moment of some sort in pop culture. I think people embrace it. As I said the other day, you know, you had 40 people who were injured, but if you'd had people shot and killed, obviously it wouldn't be remembered in the same way. So we were fortunate in so many ways that we dodged, dare I say, a bullet that way, and they... So I think that people now look at it as kind of this historical event. I'm shocked that 37 years later, there's kind of the interest and, you know, TV shows and things like that about it. But the White Stockings have, 37 years later, still failed to embrace it. So
yeah. Steve?
Yeah, there was a time when it seemed like they were coming around to embrace it, back when Rob Gallis was the marketing guy for them back in the, maybe back in the 90s, late 80s, 90s. And I don't know, since then they let Ed Farmer talk to you. I was surprised that they did that.
It was briefly, but he had a great story. He got a brawl after going to his car, right, Paul? After the
yeah, he was defending his Porsche.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, I don't mind the fact that they don't embrace it, because it kind of still gives it that outsider edge.
Right. Yeah. That's true. Now, in line with that, tell us what you're doing, Mike. All the teams you're involved with, and what your career is like. I do want to talk about the Prince Night up in St. Paul.
Oh well, we started an independent league, and we have a couple of teams in the Frontier League and St. Paul, of course, in the American Association, and I had a couple in organized baseball. But I got tired of the oversight by the commissioner's office and your parent club, so I sold those. So I currently have three independent teams, and of course, St. Paul, we just built a new ballpark last year, so it's been a lot of fun, and I like having a ownership in a minor league team, because I've worked since the Disco thing for three major league teams, and I've been fired each time, so I there's a pattern there somewhere.
You're just too good at your job, Mike.
Only two of us then who've ever said that out loud.
What was your Prince Night? Tell me what you did as a Prince tribute up in St. Paul, Mike.
Well, it had, obviously this was really, really hit home for the people in Minnesota. He was well-liked. He was viewed as one of their own. Came off the streets, was very visible, First Avenue and the like. So on that particular night, it was very straight. I mean, we made lavender and purple the uniforms of choice, and everything was Prince, and 10,000 people, showed up, and we seat 7,100. And probably a few of them were stoned, actually, now that I think about it.
They went for the lavender?
They went for the lavender, baby.
And did you play Prince music and stuff throughout the game?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a... We tried not to leave anything that would pay homage to a guy who... Paisley Park was a regular stop, and people really loved this guy. Not only was he an unbelievable, performer, but he connected with people and all walks. That's what I found so amazing about, corporate Minneapolis. There are 37 Fortune 500 companies that are headquartered in the Twin Cities. And they all conducted things at their places of business too to honor this guy. It's a pretty remarkable story.
You wrote a book that I keep referring to, Mike, called "Fun Is Good." It's right by my desk at home and stuff. It's just a great book. It's used in corporate America to teach people how to have a loose workplace and stuff. This is for Mike, and then maybe Steve can follow after this. Fun is good, but has fun changed?
Yes, it's become more important. I never thought that would be the case. I mean, I got fired by the Devil Rays, and I made a speech, and somebody hung around afterwards and said that ought to be a book, and I said, "You're brain dead." And he said, "I think we can get money." I said, "I'll write it this afternoon." But I did it based on simply the premise that we should listen to one another, be nice to one another, encourage creativity in the workplace. Basically all things that I learned from my old man. And it was well received, but it didn't break any records or anything, but it continually grew, because in 2008, when the crash hit, and people lost their money, suddenly companies were trying to do things for their employees that didn't cost money. And so now I think with everything that's happening around us in a world that becomes increasingly difficult to understand, I think fun is in short supply, and people are looking for places to go. People say millennials, they have this sense of entitlement. Well, I'll tell you, you know what they want? They want to have fun in the workplace. They want to work for a company that tells you what their values are, and they want to have a commitment to the community. I think that's... I think that makes them pretty smart. A lot smarter than I was at that age.
But, right on.
You know, Steve and I talked about this. I mean, it's just, I mean, this event really was just fun, but people look at it, like, you know, it's such an uptight, through such an uptight prison now. I mean,
it's harder to, you know what? I still am pumping out the fun every day. At least I try to. But, you know, you got to really, you have to, there are some landmines out there, and there are some waters to navigate these days. What with, all of the political correctness run amok. You know,
yeah.
I mean, witness the the revisionist history of Disco Demolition being racist and homophobic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a center where fun comes from, and it's getting kind of hard to define that center. I don't know, but fun hasn't changed that much, huh, Mike?
No, I believe that. That, you know, I stand at the gates every night in St. Paul and watch people come in, and they're happy. It's a respite. It's a place to get away from all this. You know, I mean, when people say, oh, Disco Demolition, what a tragedy. You know, that was for the baseball purist. Am I sorry it inconvenienced people? Absolutely. Did I want people to get hurt? But is it Shakespearean tragedy? Not really. A child not being able to read or starving to death, that's a tragedy. But a forfeited ball game, you know, let's face it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry to the White Sox. I hope my kid still has a job in the morning.
That's Train.
I love Train. I think the question got by me. But Steve, why did you want to do this book now? Somebody asked me that. Why didn't you want to, why not the 40th? Why was it time to bring this up now, Steve?
Well, I think as you and Paul and I talked about, with the passing of every year, the memories get a little bit more. They fade. They become a little bit more distorted. And I really thought it was important to have a good, straight-up oral history of what happened that night.
Yeah, yeah. And we tried to...
You did it. You did it.
We just tried to cover, it's a pun, but tried to cover all bases.
And, you did.
And you know what? And you stayed out of my way.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what meddling editors are like and stuff, and you gave me freedom. So that, you know, I hope people like the book, you know.
So and Hoekstra didn't tell me about it, Steve, until it was written, so that way I could say, oh, really? Could I contribute something?
Yes. Are you going to do I'm probably the only one who was at Disco Demolition 2. I tell people that story. I was down there researching the book before this on soul food and civil rights, and I went to – I knew it was Bill Veeck bobblehead night, which I went to the Charleston game. But then you want to pick up the story? You had the Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus. We blew up the records in the box in center field.
Well, you know, I said this. I was talking to Steve once about this or Roper. I can't remember. But the kids really planned that. I wanted to do Bill Veeck bobblehead night. And the kids secretly had planned this. You know, just to fly in the face of political correctness. So the kids had planned this little thing because it was the whatever it was, 33rd or 35th or whatever, anniversary. So they took a bunch of Miley Cyrus and Justin Bieber. And it was the most pathetic. it was beyond pathetic. I mean, it didn't even leave a hole behind shortstop. I mean, it was terrible.
But what was funny, I remember I told people that you had a lot of security there just in case something was going to happen.
Yeah, just in case Michael Bolton showed up and wanted to get on the field.
We got a few minutes left. I want everybody to say, what are they doing? Anything you want to plug, Paul? What's going on?
No, but I think Mike Veeck should do stand-up comedy.
Yeah, really?
Yeah,
I
yeah,
agree.
Yeah, yeah. Dave and Bob, what's going on? Dave, tell us what you're doing with you and Cindy.
Well, we kind of retired out of vending, and we opened a store called Let's Tailgate in Evanston. And it's a licensed fan shop.
I met you at the book signing.
Right, right. Yeah, we were talking. You remember. And we've been there for 20 years now. And our anniversary is actually Disco Demolition, July 12th. So I can't forget that.
No, you cannot.
And Cindy,
wow. I'm sorry I haven't sent you a card.
Next
it was a coincidence.
Next.
Cindy, how'd you guys meet? I knew you from the bleachers back in the 70s with the Bill Buckner button.
Yes, my all-time favorite Cub. Dave and I met at the ballparks. We worked together for years. I worked at the ballpark. I started in 1979. I worked for 32 years there. At all the ballparks.
And there were very few female vendors, if any?
There were a few, not too many.
Were you the first one at Soldier Field?
Yes.
Tell us about that real quick.
They did not let women into Soldier Field. I was a big Bear fan, and I persisted, and then they finally let me in to vent.
And what did you sell?
Coke, ice cream.
Yeah.
Peanuts.
Hey, just for the record, that's sexist.
Yeah. A quick funny story. Wherever we go, they always reckon, hey, you're the beer girl at the ballpark at Cubs or something. They don't remember me. We were at the Rose Bowl Northwestern 1995, and everybody went to OJ's house to see it. You know, what was going on at that time. And sure enough, a guy goes, hey, you're a beer vendor at Wrigley Field.
And Bob, what are you doing? You're still vending?
Yes, 40th season. Nobody's ever croaked while vending in the aisles. I want to keep that option open. You're the first.
There's a great promotion there, Bob.
Do you work a specific section?
Yeah, well, when you get this many years in, you get to work the primo seats. So I'm at Wrigley between the dugouts, rather, close to the field. I gave up Comiskey, which I still call Comiskey, a couple of years back.
Bob's a little modest. He's the beer vendor trivia baseball card giveaway guy, and he does it at Bear games too.
Yeah. Yeah. Bob, do you want to read something? Close us out with a little poem, and then that would be a good way to send off the show. I want to thank all you guys. Thanks, Michael, for hanging in for the whole hour from Charleston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it. Thank you all.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for taking time out from your wedding thing.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks
hey, I was here for the whole hour, too, man. The guy didn't call me.
You're covered.
I want credit for the full hour.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, Steve, did your band play at the wedding?
No. It was, no. And nothing caught on fire.
Yeah, very good. That's good, Steve. I'll plug the book one more time. I'm so bad at this, but it's Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. Steve Dahl with Dave Hoekstra, Paul Nacken with a foreword by Bob Odenkirk. And that's on Curbside Splendor. Thanks. And Bob Chicoine is going to sign us off with a little prose, okay?
In center field during Disco Demolition Night, you would have found the drowned from the Eastland disaster starting a fire to burn away their water. Near second base, you'd have found the suffocated from the Iroquois Theater jumping for joy in the smoky air. By the pitcher's mound, you'd have found the gunned-down strikers from Republic Steel trying their toeholds on the rubber. It felt so good to be free again, to commingle unnoticed with the living, to let their old tragedies surrender like cheap trick, to being goofy, silly, unlucky go happy, to let the half of life they missed out on be just the forfeited nightcap of a doubleheader. And if disco does indeed suck, then the long death worth going back to must be no less than rock and roll.